Right. Well, I do feel guilty about cutting short the discussion after the last speaker, so please feel free to ask him questions during my discussion time. I won't be offended. Maybe he will be, but I won't be offended. So yes, this is going to continue in the same spirit. This is a theory talk. It's about transport and topological insulators and how that connects to questions in spintronics. At least it's mostly about that. So I'm going to focus a lot more on connections with magnetism and with magnetoelectricity. So this is an area where we've been working for some time with a lot of people, but let me mention in particular Jens Bardersen, who's now a group leader in Dresden, and Ronnie Alon, who's a postdoc with me at Berkeley. So I do want to give a quick introduction to topological insulators, basically. And already at the semi-classical level, there's some obvious reasons why these might be interesting from the point of view of spintronics. There's this spin-momentum locking that Nitin mentioned. I want to focus then on maybe more fundamental differences where, in a sense, these are half as many degrees of freedom as a normal metal, either for the 2D surface of the 3D TI or the 1D helical edge. So that's a factor of two. When is that factor of two interesting? What are new effects you get by having, in a sense, half of an ordinary metal, either in normal state transport, or I'll say a little bit about what happens if I couple to a superconductor. Then, if I take the helical edge and ask about trying to probe time reversal by putting on a magnetic perturbation, it winds up mapping onto a famous problem in transport, which is one of the few cases where we can solve a non-equilibrium problem basically exactly. And then I think I'll skip this, but I'll say a little bit about magnetoelectrics and other materials that this kind of relates to. So where this started, this field of topological insulators, was thinking about spin-orbit coupling, which to this audience is well known. Let me just think about terms like L dot S, where L is orbital and S is spin, angular momentum. So if I fix the spin up, this is a momentum-dependent force, so it's a little bit like a magnetic field. And I could imagine preparing a system where spin up sees an effective magnetic field that puts it in a quantum Hall state with edge going one way. Well, the time reversal symmetry of spin orbit coupling then means that spin down has to see an effective magnetic field in the opposite direction. So people came up with models where spins at the edge would propagate one way for spin up, the other way for spin down. And it was hoped that this would be some kind of topological phase, but it was really only starting in 2005 that why this actually can work was understood. And to explain that was why that was a surprise, normally we'd say, okay, this is stable because if I've only got electrons moving in one direction at low energy, there's nowhere for them to backscatter to. So I can put on impurities and there still won't be localization. While it was generally believed that if you made this edge, and I think about a real sample with scattering, I will scatter the right movers into the left movers. Once I have disorder in spin orbit coupling, this one-dimensional system will become localized like a quantum wire, and I won't really get any topological edge or stable behavior. And understanding why that's not right goes down to the difference between time reversal symmetry of spin orbit coupling and a real magnetic field, in that this is even under time reversal. And in particular, how does that deal with fermions, electrons? So I want to quickly sketch a simplified argument for why that works, but the real idea was in this paper by Kane and Malee. And what they basically showed was that all the standard topological invariants before then would not have told you that this edge is stable, but there is actually a reason why it's stable. There's a sort of Z2 invariant or odd-even topology that tells you that this edge has to survive, and there's actually, in hindsight, a very simple way to see that just by looking at the edge. So I want to convince you basically why half of a quantum wire is stable even though a full quantum wire is not stable, and then going from that to 3D, which I'm going to focus on, is not very hard. So why is there an odd-even effect, and how is this seen in transport? Well, here is where time reversal symmetry and how it acts on fermions comes in. And let me just think about, suppose I made that one-dimensional edge, I want to argue that it's actually stable if it has one right-moving branch and one left-moving branch. So this is energy versus momentum along the edge. These are the electronic states, and I put a solid circle if it's occupied. So the idea goes back to something from the early days of quantum mechanics, and I'll go quickly because I think many people here know this. Cramer's degeneracy is the statement that time reversal invariant Hamiltonians of spin half particles always have at least twofold degenerate eigenstates. In other words, if I take an eigenstate of a time reversal invariant system of fermions, then it's always degenerate with and different from its time reversal conjugate. Well, for bosons, a state can be just the same thing as its time reversal conjugate. So a consequence of that is that you can't mix the two states that make up one of these degenerate pairs. Because if I could, I would split the pair, and that would violate the theorem. So if I look at this energy versus momentum picture, well, this state here, for example, is Cramer's conjugate to that state, which means that no time reversal invariant perturbation is going to mix the two. Or in transport language, there's no backscattering between this state and that state. That's the only thing that could degrade the current at low voltage and temperature. So this edge is actually stable, and I should see ballistic transport at low enough voltage and temperature. Now, a difference between this and the integer quantum Hall effect, which is maybe important for applications, especially as we go up in temperature, is that if I'm up here somewhere, higher in energy, and I inelastically scatter off a phonon, nothing prevents me from falling down into that state there. So elastic scattering is protected, but other kinds of scattering are not. And if you're interested in getting above a Kelvin, say, that might actually matter. So quickly, if I have an ordinary quantum wire, the reason why that's not protected is that now there are more scattering processes. That same one is still forbidden. So this would be something like a carbon nanotube with both right movers and left movers of both spins. But this up-to-up process is not protected by time reversal. So the key point to make is that half a quantum wire is stable, a full quantum wire is not. If I have time reversal symmetry, that whole distinction disappears if I break time reversal, which we're going to do later. So how could I see this experimentally? Well, if I have ballistic transport along the edge of a bulk insulator, and if one edge is half a quantum wire, then taking the full sample and measuring its effectively two-terminal conductance should give me the conductance of one quantum wire, which is 2e squared over h. And indeed, a plateau in the two-terminal conductance is seen at 2e squared over h for some range of gate voltage, fairly low temperature again. But this was a very impressive experiment. It certainly deserved all the recognition it's gotten. So in 3D, I will not go through the bulk topology. There are actually four Z2 invariants, three of which are kind of layered versions of 2D and called weak topological invariants. The fourth one is kind of the magical one, and it doesn't really have any analog in quantum Hall physics. In other words, there is a genuinely 3D topological insulator, even though there's not a 3D quantum Hall effect in the same way. And its consequence is that if you have a strong topological insulator, it has an odd number of these Dirac cones at the surface. And the way I count, odd means that there's one spin state at each K. Or maybe a better topological way to state it is that there are an odd number of sheets of the Fermi surface. And that's very fundamental. We believe that no two-dimensional electron system with time reversal symmetry can do this. We think that those always have to have an even number of sheets. So that's saying I've got half as many sheets, maybe that will do something interesting. But leaving aside the quantum nature of counting sheets of the Fermi surface, you can already see that if momentum is tied to spin direction in this very direct way, maybe that's useful for something. And of course, one reason why this is interesting experimentally is that there are some fairly ordinary 3D materials that are in this topological class, even up to fairly high temperatures. So this is early data by Zahid Hassan on bismuth selenide and collaborators. So this material has a bulk band gap of about 0.3 eV. There appear to be states in the gap that are at the surface. And indeed, if you look at their spin, you find that they have the predicted spin structure for the topological insulator surface state. So these materials have somehow been very successful as far as ARPES goes. And transport, despite a lot of heroic effort and progress, is not quite as easy. But it's starting to work out pretty well. So let's try and use it for something. So anyway, this is the very quick picture of what I just said. The 3D topological insulator is something where electrons move in different directions and their spin is locked to their momentum. So maybe the simplest way to use this for spintronics is to take an effect that experts will know is already there in any quantum well with spin orbit coupling and argue that it might be larger here. So by symmetries, there's a relationship in a time reversal invariant system between charge current and spin density, and between charge density and spin current. So an easy thing to do is to run a charge current. That, in any quantum well with spin orbit coupling, will create a spin density. But normally, that spin density is quite small because there are two sheets of the Fermi surface that cancel each other out. if I've only got one sheet of the Fermi surface, so for example, if I'm only looking at the top surface of a topological insulator, well, running a current in ordinary metallic transport just kind of shifts over the occupied Fermi sea. Now I've got more electrons with this spin than with that spin. I drew the spins parallel for simplicity. That gives me a pretty large spin density. And these would cancel out if I had a perfectly symmetric thin film where the top surface was the same as the bottom surface. But we know, since we're always putting these thin films on substrates, that we never actually have that symmetry. So it's worthwhile trying to calculate, and this is with Oleg Yazyev and Steve Louis, just to show that these materials are at least reasonably accessible to microscopic calculations. So with this kind of thing, you can learn, for example, how some of these spin torque devices might work. So for example, there was a nice proposal by Garate and friends that if you use this spin orbit locking, spin momentum locking, you can make a nice kind of spin torque device where you run the current in the topological insulator surface and you try to switch a magnetic field sitting on top, which the Dan Ralph's group has had a lot of progress on, I understand. So you could also calculate sort of the strength of the spin polarization and things like that, and it's not quite 100%, but it's still pretty significant. But that is kind of easier than what I now want to talk about, because that is, in a sense, simply a number. It's a number of about 100 for what we put on. That is, the spin orbit effect, the coupling here, is enhanced by about 100 compared to a normal quantum well. But let's say we want to do something that's more fundamentally restricted to topological insulators, where there's some effect that's just not there in graphene or a normal metal. And effects like that basically have to use this factor of 2. So the way to think about the 3D topological insulator is that I took a normal metal and I cut it in half and put one half at the top surface and one half at the bottom surface, and that's what made it stable to non-magnetic disorder. What can we do with it that might be interesting beyond that? And everything I'm going to talk about for the next few slides is with this idealized single Dirac cone Hamiltonian plus Zeeman coupling. So I did the one calculation on the previous slide with actual materials, and now this is a model Dirac fermion. So there has been work, especially since the samples got better and became better bulk insulators, on just trying to do Shubnikov-de-Haas oscillations, for example, and see that there's a Dirac cone. But even in the early days, there was a clever way to look for Dirac cones or look for unusual surface states that didn't require having a bulk insulator. And this was the idea. This is from Yi Chui's group at Stanford. Let me take a nano ribbon, say something about 100 nanometers on a side of a 3D topological insulator, which will have this one surface Dirac cone, let's idealize, running around it. And I want to put a magnetic field along the cylinder. And the point of doing that is that the flux effect of that magnetic field, the Aronov-Bohm effect, say, will depend on, if you like, what is the radius of the electron trajectory around it. Or in other words, the surface states feel the flux from the magnetic field differently from how the bulk feels it. So what you do in practice is measure the magnetoconductance. So this is R versus magnetic field. You can see various peaks. If you Fourier transform that, and you put in the geometrical factor, which is your observed cross-sectional area of this wire, you see that there are strong peaks at H over E and H over 2E, which are the Aronov-Bohm and Charvin-Charvin effects in transport. So our claim is, and there's some now support from this from a group at Purdue, maybe others, if you measure this more carefully with more samples, you will sometimes see this, where resistance increases with B. You'll sometimes see the opposite effect, and sometimes you'll see something even more surprising, at least if you can dope the sample closer to the Dirac point, or gate it. So what I want to argue is, if you do this experiment carefully and can get close to the Dirac point, then something magical happens when the flux through the ribbon is exactly half a flux quantum, or pi flux. Basically, all the modes are then localized except for one, and that protected mode is basically the helical edge of the 2D quantum spin Hall effect. So this is a way to take 3D topological insulators with the nice big room temperature gap and try to mimic the quantized transport helical edge of the 2D quantum spin Hall effect. So here are some numerical calculations with this order. So if I'm far from the Dirac point, which is this axis, then the conductance gets larger. And here, say, is where that Stanford experiment is, where as a function of chemical potential, these three different curves are three different values of the flux. Sometimes the peak conductance is at zero flux, sometimes the peak conductance is at pi flux, and they basically alternate with chemical potential. It's kind of a counting argument of how many states are below the chemical potential. Where things get kind of interesting is down here, as I get close to the Dirac point or have a long wire, then what you see is the conductance is basically zero by localization for all the fluxes other than 1/2. At 1/2, the conductance is going to precisely E squared over H. So the key is to find samples where the conductance is getting in the neighborhood of E squared over H, because that's where localization and effects like that kick in. The basic picture for why this is true, let me give that now. The topological insulator surface state has this spin momentum locking, which means that as an electron momentum goes around the cylinder, there is a rotation of the spin through 2 pi, which gives a -1. That's not there in graphene, for example. That -1 spin rotation Berry phase is exactly compensated by the Aronov-Bohm phase of the magnetic field through the cylinder. So those two factors of -1 get me back to protected conduction, which is that E squared over H. So what we worked on more recently is just the superconducting version of this, and I'll go through this quickly. Basically, there's a lot of reason to be interested in what happens if I have a vortex core and a superconductor insulator, topological insulator junction. It was shown by Fu and Kane, building on some work of Sato, that there should be Majorana fermion states at the boundaries between these two. The way that's connected to what I said before, as was pointed out by Marcel Frenz and possibly others, if I make a topological insulator nanowire, so basically if I go back to this picture and instead of putting these materials outside the vortex core, I put them inside, I still get Majoranas in this system. So we were interested in how does the actual transport work if I were to make this experimental geometry of a topological insulator nanowire sitting on superconducting contacts with a magnetic field through it. So we know that even in the normal state, there's something a bit interesting in the magnetic field dependence. It turns out that the signal is even stronger in the superconducting state, and it's really showing that there is a Majorana mode. So this is somehow known already as an empirical fact that in topological insulators, it seems like that when you measure supercurrents, they can be surface dominated even when normal transport is bulk dominated. You can kind of speculate why. We find that also in our numerical calculation. It's known that if you have a superconducting flux difference of pi, superconducting phase difference of pi, you can get Majoranas in this kind of geometry. And here we have mentioned various other realizations of this idea. The way I want to stress this maybe for a more general audience that is not particularly interested in Majoranas is that there's a connection between a zero energy Majorana state and the following. This is the Andreev state spectrum as a function of superconducting phase difference. It involves basically the transmission probabilities of different modes, these tau sub n. And the only way to get a zero energy Andreev state, which is the one that has the potential to be a Majorana, is if you have two things happen. You have a phase difference of pi and a perfectly transmitted mode. What I just told you before is how to make a perfectly transmitted mode. So that says we can get a zero energy Andreev state, basically a Majorana, it's a delocalized Majorana, to be fair, if I put on this proper phase difference. And indeed, that's right. So this is a commonly measured quantity, ICRN, supercurrent times normal state resistance. So normal state conductance would have a peak here. This is saying that supercurrent has an even larger peak because I realize that for a disordered sample for various chemical potentials, there's pretty much always an observable peak at 1/2 flux quantum, and it becomes quite large as I get close to the Dirac point. So this is our favorite smoking gun for some kind of Majorana physics, but let me point out to anyone who's interested in doing this, there's already something interesting in the normal state, which would be creating the helical edge. This is saying that in the superconducting state, it has a Majorana, and it's even stronger. Okay, the problem is this is, of course, low-temperature physics, so if you're interested in Majoranas for applications, maybe it's or in room temperature applications in general, perhaps is not relevant. But aside from going to low temperature, we think that everything else about this experiment is pretty plausible. So now I want to get back to, real room temperature effects that have actually been of interest to the applied spintronics community, but don't involve topological insulators, and claim that you learn something from topological insulators that is useful more generally. So something that at least I've heard discussed for spintronic readouts are what are called multiferroic materials, or more generally, materials that have a linear magnetoelectric effect. So magnetoelectric effect just means that if I take a solid with low enough symmetry, an electric field produces a magnetic moment and vice versa. To be precise, there's some magnetoelectric response tensor, which I'll call alpha. And this goes back to at least the 50s. It was studied very thoroughly in the former Soviet Union, for example. But part of it, theoretically, was not quite understood until topological insulators. So it's been understood for a while that topological insulators have, in a sense, a quantized magnetoelectric effect. This tensor in a topological insulator is perfectly diagonal and quantized. What I want to focus on, although I'm not going to give the details of our theory, is that actually you can work out the entire electronic contribution to this tensor, and it has a part which is always geometric, the so-called Chern-Simons form, and it's got other parts as well. The main reason why that matters is the following. In topological insulators, it has not yet been possible to measure this quantized magnetoelectric effect. It would be nice, but so far, as you heard in the previous talk, it's very hard to make a gap surface state and see this kind of quantization. Magnetoelectric effects in general are measured all the time. So one benchmark material, not a topological insulator, just a multiferroic insulator, to be precise, a magnetoelectric insulator, is CR203, which has a magnetoelectric response in terms of this part. Its magnitude is 24 times smaller than a topological insulator. So what you can work out is, of all the different ways that a material can have a magnetoelectric coupling, so it could be from the electronic polarization or the ionic part, and it could be from the orbital magnetic moment or the spin part, this is the one that's kind of the most interesting theoretically and requires you to know, or at least the way it was understood was by something out of topological insulators. And it might also be the one that's most useful for spintronic applications because, first of all, this one is fast. And second, if you don't use the ions, you don't degrade the material. So in most practical multiferroics, this box is not the major contributor to the magnetoelectric effect. It's actually other boxes. However, this box is the one that has the most ideal features for electronic applications, so maybe that will be useful for some kind of spintronic device. So the last thing I wanted to talk about was to go back to the 2D quantum spin Hall edge and try to see how can we test the spin properties of this edge. So I said that time reversal was important. What does that really mean experimentally? So this is the slide I showed before. So one thing you might wonder about, in one dimension, we know that electron interactions are in principle strong enough that we don't get a Fermi liquid, we get a so-called Luttinger liquid. So why don't I see Luttinger liquid effects on this 2E squared over H? So for example, does the fact that 2E squared over H is observed here mean that the edge is somehow non-interacting? And the answer is no. It was understood in the 90s that even if you have a Luttinger liquid, if there's no disorder and it's between Fermi liquid contacts, you don't measure any renormalization of the two-terminal conductance. So that is almost a downer if you like interactions. It says that in the two-terminal conductance of a clean sample, or in general, a sample with no backscattering, interactions don't do very much. So we want to understand two things. What do interactions do? And connected to that, how can we actually tell experimentally that time reversal is as important as we think it is? So the idea, rather than put on a magnetic layer, like in the previous talk, I want to think about one small magnetic region at one edge of the quantum spin Hall effect. So this is not a Kondo impurity. There's a lot of very interesting physics if you have a dynamical magnetic impurity. This is just a localized magnetic field, is the way to think about it. And the reason I want to study that is that that's the simplest way to create backscattering at this one point. So the good news is this is a, in terms of counting degrees of freedom, this is a spinless Luttinger liquid with backscattering at one point. So we would think of it as a helical liquid, but you can map that onto the spinless Luttinger liquid. And about the only non-equilibrium interacting problem we know how to solve is the spinless Luttinger liquid with one impurity. This is work of Fendley, Ludwig, and Soler, and some later papers in the mid-90s. So the claim is that by a series of mappings, you can understand what is the exact IV curve you should measure, and also the exact conductance as a function of temperature, as you put on this magnetic impurity and gradually turn off the protection of the quantum spin Hall edge. And if you measure that, so this is basically combining together some fairly intricate calculations that were done in the quantum Hall context. I'll tell you what's maybe different from the quantum Hall context in a second. So you want to figure out how large is the bare backscattering from your magnetic dot. Use this in this exact solution, which is thermodynamic Bethe-Ansatz equations. And there's an interesting subtlety which is related to that. Why does the two terminal conductance not show interactions? And one nice paper explaining that was by Egger and Graubert. So if you combine that all together, what you get are simply, in this case, conductance versus temperature curves. So the idea is that this is 1 over temperature, to be precise. As I go to low temperature, the conductance should drop from E squared over H to 0. The perturbative, the sort of behavior at the two extremes is known from Kane-Fisher physics. What happens in between is what's given by this exact solution. And basically, by measuring which curve of these you see, and they don't look that different, but this is a log scale, so they're a little bit more different than they look in this plot, you can pull out what is the Luttinger parameter at the edge. And the reason why this is interesting is that the one case this solution was used before was in the fractional quantum Hall effect, where the Luttinger parameter, effectively the interaction strength, is totally quantized. Here it isn't. So here you're actually using it to probe something that you don't know. So anyway, at a zeroth order, this would prove that we actually understood time reversal breaking, but even the details of the curve would have a lot of information. So the experimental status is kind of interesting. Ruy-Ruy-Du has a different quantum spin Hall material where he has looked at magnetic field effects, and right now they're very puzzling. He doesn't always even see conductance go down in the magnetic field, so it's not exactly clear, but he has a nice paper on that puzzle. So I think at the moment, at least on his material, it may be understood in Mercury-Telluride, the effect of magnetic field on transport at the quantum spin Hall edge is still a bit of a puzzle, even though we can solve this one simple case. So let me start concluding. I have one slide to try to spark discussion after this. So there's already possibly useful, and that possibly is maybe the key, useful stuff from 3D topological insulators, even if you just think about spin momentum locking. If you want to think about more subtle quantum mechanical effects, then there's a way to use the spin momentum locking at the quantum level to make this helical edge at high temperature if you're willing to put on a pi flux. So that's not a huge magnetic field necessarily, but it is some magnetic field, which is not ideal. Transport at the quantum spin Hall edge is kind of an interesting quantum impurity problem, which has some differences, namely that it's not quantized compared to the fractional quantum Hall effect. And then maybe the big question for discussion is what I don't know really, or what are practical spintronic applications that topological insulators might actually help us solve? And then one little advertisement. For one-dimensional transport and non-equilibrium in general, there's been a lot of progress by many groups, and we're one group trying to do this, to actually do correlated thermodynamic limit calculations using density matrix and normalization groups. So if you have a one-dimensional transport problem, it would have been probably totally inaccessible numerically, at least if you wanted strong correlations until 5 years ago, but now it is actually possible to solve some of those, and I would love to talk to anyone about that. For discussion, there's clearly basic spintronics in topological insulators, if it means just interesting basic physics with spin. The hard question, which is apparent if you go to some of these DARPA meetings, but a lot of people have ideas, is there any case where it's better to use topological insulators than something like a dilute magnetic semiconductor or something like that? So just to quickly summarize some of the things people are talking about, interconnects are actually a big problem in industry. They would love something better than copper as they go to smaller sizes. This quantum anomalous Hall effect is fairly exciting in that context, as that is a chiral protected one-dimensional conductor. Of course, it's somewhat limited to low temperature, so making some kind of interconnect is a great challenge. Interfacing with magnetism, for example, magnetic memory, as Professor Samarth talked about, is another nice challenge. And then finally, there are some ideas for logic, which is certainly a huge question in industry, but at the moment, it's very hard to show that topological insulators, aside from being interesting, are actually better on the application side, and it would be great to learn what spintronics people want to do. So let me wrap up there. Thank you.
Okay, we have time for questions.
Sorry, wait, this is your microphone. In the multi-heroic part, you mentioned that something is quantized. Can you demonstrate?
Yes.
That?
So this is actually a neat signature of having one Dirac fermion that I didn't talk about. So it may be easiest if I, well, I'm not sure if I can draw a picture that everyone can see. All right, so here's the basic idea. So if I've got one Dirac fermion at the edge, then instead of an integer Hall effect, I see a half-integer Hall effect, but with steps by integers. So this is kind of a known property of one Dirac fermion. So in a sense, an ordinary metal is two Dirac fermions, and I see integer Hall effect. I see half-integer Hall effect with one Dirac fermion. Now, what does that have to do with the magnetoelectric effect? Well, E dot B, a particular kind of magnetoelectric effect, this is a total derivative, basically, of A dA. A is the electromagnetic vector potential. And this ADA, so-called Chern-Simons term, is exactly equivalent to a sigma xy at the surface. So in other words, this wouldn't work for E cross B or other kinds of magnetoelectric coupling, but there's something special about the diagonal part of magnetoelectric coupling. So the diagonal part means that I apply an electric field and I get a magnetic moment in the same direction. Basically, E dot B is, in a sense, topological, or at least it's a boundary term, and bulk E dot B is exactly the same thing as sigma xy at the surface. So to have a half-integer quantized sigma xy at the surface, if I could gap the surface, which is what happens in topological insulators, is the same thing as a quantized bulk E dot B. So this is a kind of a surprising fact, but at a mathematical level, it's exactly the same thing, in that it's just the matter of going to the boundary and realizing that this is a total derivative. So what that should predict, for example, if I could put, let me maybe draw a picture for how this works. Suppose I had a slab. I'm going to think about, if I had my 3D topological insulator and I could gap the surface, what I'm telling you is that there's no way to gap the surface in principle so that it doesn't have a Hall effect. It has to have a Hall effect, let's say E squared over 2H. And the way the geometry works, if I apply an electric field to this, think about what happens. Well, currents will run perpendicular to it. And let's say they run that way here. It turns out that if there's no gap around the surface, they have to run the opposite way here. So an electric field introduces circulating currents around the boundary, which produce an induced magnetic moment. So that's kind of the physical picture of how having a surface Hall effect is equivalent to a bulk magnetoelectric effect. It's quantized in topological insulators, but what's kind of interesting, maybe the reason why this was not worked out beforehand, is that the same term that gives you quantization in topological insulators is actually present in all multiferroics. It's just not quantized. It's sometimes called the Chern-Simons term of the Berry phase of the electrons. Yeah.
Yeah, hi. I had a question on the multiferroics. Typically, when you talk about multiferroics, besides the P and M coupling, there's a magnetoelastic coupling also, which should be taken into account. So I was wondering, if you do take that into account, do you have any comments on how the alpha theta for an equivalent magnetoelastic degree of freedom might affect any of the physics that you're discussing? Because
So I think those are all, let me put it this way. The only thing that we did that was new was, what is the contribution that comes purely from electron motion with the fixed lattice. So that's what I mean by saying electronic P as opposed to ionic P and so on. So our calculation is frozen lattice. There are other contributions related, for example, to how much does the material actually deform, which I called ionic. So my main argument for why these might be nicer, in a sense, is, first of all, if I don't have to move the ions, everything is fast, and second, if I don't have to move the ions, it doesn't tend to degrade the material. So for example, with ferroelectrics, this was a big practical problem for many years, that they couldn't be switched that many times, and they finally figured out how to get around it to some extent. It's still a bit of a problem with things like BFO. So I guess I think that the contributions you're talking about are there, and they basically add to the contributions I'm talking about. But they are sort of relevant at different frequency ranges, and they don't, as far as I know, have any geometric interpretation, Berry phase interpretation.
Yeah, for this moment and the spin locked. So which direction of the spin should point to?
Yeah, predominantly in real.
You have two directions.
Right. No, I wasn't capable of making the clear picture with the true physical spin direction in one case. The true physical spin direction is largely perpendicular to K, and in the plane.
In plane, but why not perpendicular to the plane?
It can have a perpendicular component.
And then I can even rotate, right? In all directions.
Maybe there's a statement about what is most okay. The only, as far as I can tell. The only basic requirement from time reversal is that whatever the spin direction is at k, it has to be opposite at minus k. However, as a statement about the way the materials actually work, in all the ones I know, the spin direction is dominantly in plane and dominantly perpendicular to k.
Uh-huh.
And you could probably work out why that's true based on crystalline symmetries and the symmetries of the interface. It definitely, as you move around, so for example, as you get away from the Dirac point and the cone starts to warp, you definitely get out-of-plane components.
Uh-huh. So what would be the magneto resistance in that case?
Well, the nice thing about that pi flux effect, that doesn't actually care. If you like, whatever the spin direction is as it goes around the Fermi surface, it is rotating through 2 pi in the end. So I'm still picking up a minus 1. So if you like, the magneto, the quantized effect at pi flux I talked about is sort of independent of the details of the spin rotation.
Right, but I can imagine if I apply external magnetic fields, right, that will tilt the spin.
Yes.
And then if you really rigid, locked the angle, the momentum with the spin, then I will expect the motion of the electron will be highly affected. So you should have extremely strong magneto resistance.
But I think once you put on, okay, one effect of putting on such a strong magnetic field is that you weaken the locking. But I guess, I mean, the only thing I can say about experimental reality is for some of the effects I talked about, it's nice to have a fairly large ribbon so that the magnetic field is not that large. Basically, if you want to be dominated by flux effects rather than field effects, you want a fairly small field, which means a large ribbon. The field effects, there is a lot of interesting stuff that happens. You know, you open up a gap, and certainly the spin Berry phase is no longer quantized to pi once you've broken time reversal. But the details of how that modifies magnetotransport, I don't know.
Okay, next question.
So actually I have a question about your statement with the superconductors, that if I put the superconductor on the top of a topological insulator, then in general bulk doesn't matter. So I would naively expect that if I put superconductor, then I obviously have proximity effect and tunneling of Cooper pairs. But I do not understand why suddenly I should go from the bulk to the surface conductivity. Could you explain this?
Well, it doesn't, it's not by any means a perfect statement. It's an experimental statement. So, for example, probably the best is Amir Jacobi's data on what he does is measure Fraunhofer patterns on one of Mollenkamp's samples. He's basically doing this with a magnetic field like that. And by measuring the flux dependence of the critical current, you can basically map out where is the current flowing and make pictures. And what he finds is that the current is basically pretty well concentrated at the edge. The supercurrent is pretty well concentrated at the edge and appears to be slightly more concentrated in the sense that it lasts longer at the edge, even when ordinary transport is getting to be more than 2e squared over h. So if you want some speculation for why that's true, the main difference, I don't know as much about Mercury telluride as about the 3D TIs, but I think the main difference is between bulk transport and surface transport. Bulk transport you can probably think of as having a reasonable carrier density but extremely short mean free paths, while surface probably the mean free path is longer because the bulk is some kind of impurity conduction basically. And it's known that if you look at the scaling of how supercurrent coupling works, if you compare two things with the same normal state conductance, it's better to have fewer carriers and longer mean free path if you want to couple them. But this is a statement that's kind of at the factor of 2 or 3 level. It's not like a theoretical, rigid thing. It just seems that in samples so far, you can be slightly more surface dominated than bulk dominated in the supercurrent, even when that's not true in normal state. Well, but I guess this is, even if this is even going to gate voltages where there starts to be some bulk, not a theorem.
I wanted to ask one question myself, since I now have both microphones, so no one can stop me.
You can ask it in stereo.
Yeah, very good. This one's off, I hope. Coming back to this early part of your talk where you talk about the nano ribbon or cylinder with a pi flux through it, and there's at least some simple-minded model would say you get a helical edge running along there. Is that really true? Let me imagine I have a clean system, translationally invariant system. Then I would think there'd be some effective low energy theory, maybe, if that's even approximately true, that would be a helical Luttinger liquid. And there are really two independent backscattering terms that are allowed, two real numbers that characterize a backscattering. Since you've actually broken time reversal symmetry by...
Oh, no, okay, no, the key thing is I am only, okay, so this is maybe
so
what you mean by simple
kind
mind.
Of realistic scenario, I would have thought you have to tune two parameters to actually get the gap to vanish.
Right, no, I'm assuming that I can be in the limit where I still have time reversal because the flux over the whole area is of order pi, but the field is small. So once if I include the fact that there is actually a field as well as a flux, then there starts to be backscattering. So I think that would be, which is kind of consistent with what we expect about 1D channels.
Okay, I think we have time for maybe one more question. There was one back there, but it's gone away, I think.
So I just wanted to follow up on Evelyn's question. You're talking about the preferential coupling of the superconductivity when it's proximity induced to the surface state. So I think there are several experiments now on the 3D systems at least. And in our experiment, where we looked at these nano ribbons, which, where we introduced proximity effect, the key length scale seemed to be, what made sense was that the inelastic coherence length, so the mean free path associated inelastic scattering, was really the one that seemed to make sense from the, from the viewpoint that it's coupling to the surface state and not to the bulk. Because we're always dominated by bulk transport when the contacts are normal, but you could get a supercurrent over distances which were two or three times larger than you would expect based upon the bulk transport.
If it's inelastic scattering, it should be pretty temperature dependent.
It is, and so as long as we were using a superconductor that had a fairly high TC of something like 5 or 6 Kelvin, so I think that's the relevant length scale. But I still don't understand why it couples to the surface state preferentially. And even the experiments from Illinois seem to bring the same idea. So Nadia Mason's experiments.
Yeah, one hears somehow commonly that the surface state is almost easier to see in the superconducting transport.
Right.
But,
Okay, it's time for a coffee break. Let's thank Joel again. We'll be back at 11:00.